We're talking with Ed Mead. He is the editor of Prison Focus. He is also a former political prisoner, and he runs the Prison Art website, which sells the arts and crafts from prisoners. We're talking with him about the upcoming hunger strike by Pelican Bay State prisoners. How are you doing, Mr. Mead?
I'm doing just fine, and thank you for having me on the show.
Can you, first of all, tell me what the prisoners are asking for?
I will. But first, let me give you just a little bit of background. These guys are held in the security housing unit, the SHU, indefinitely because they've been validated as gang members. And let me read just a quick paragraph here from what a prisoner. Well, what's important for your listeners to understand, and that's the cruelty of the policy sanctioned by the state that allows the Department of Corrections to place men and women in an indefinite SHU program only on the word of a prison informer, where there's no offense, no violence, no gang or criminal activity, yet prisoners who are held in indeterminate SHU are held, well, indefinitely, for the rest of their lives in SHU and adjustment centers across the state of California. So what happens is they validate somebody as a gang member, and they want this and this person wants to get out of the SHU. Well, all they have to do is name somebody else as a gang member. That's called debriefing, and they get out and they go to something called a soft yard, and the person that they named gets locked up in indefinite SHU. And so the people who are engaging in this hunger strike are those who refuse to become snitches, who refuse to tell on other people, because once you've informed, you know, you become theirs. I mean, you're they own you for the rest of your life. Well, let me just read three short paragraphs from another letter from a prisoner, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. And this is how the process of validation as a gang member takes place. He writes, in November of 1986, I was taken off the prison's general population yard of Old Folsom and placed in the newly opened security housing unit of New Folsom. The reason I was given was that there was a confidential memo in my file that connected me to a so-called prison gang. As I later found out under appeal, there was no such memo in my file, but by this time, there were already a few other memos from debriefers that would take the place of that non-existent memo. I was told that if I wanted to get out of the SHU, I would have to confess to all the illegal activities I'd ever been involved in during the course of my life, and I would also have to inform on and incriminate others. And this, of course, is called the process of debriefing. Another prisoner that writes me says that he had he's a Hispanic prisoner, and he had some Aztec drawings that he had torn out of a lowrider magazine. And so they found these Aztec drawings, and they said that that was gang material, that was gang-related. And so they validated him as a gang member, locked him up, and he's there indefinitely until he, you know, decides to snitch or not. I mean, you just don't get out. And a lot of these guys are, the policy, everything in the SHU is designed to get these guys to debrief, to snitch, to become rats, whether it's the visits, the food, the conditions, recreation, everything is pressured, is aimed at getting these guys to debrief. And the prisoner who are going on hunger strike, whether gang members or not, are the people who have sufficient principles that they are not going to become informants for the state. And as a result of that, some of these guys have been in that SHU for over 20 years.
Now, I know that there's other folks in the SHU, and the SHU stands for a Security Housing Unit, who are there for other reasons, but the folks who are participating in the hunger strike, they are all folks who have been asked to snitch and they're refusing to do so? Or are there others who are in the SHU and just protesting conditions in the SHU?
These are primarily men who have been validated as gang members. And the essence of their demands is to roll back that policy. You want me to go over the five core demands that they've raised?
Yeah, and as you're doing that, if you could also paint a picture for the listeners of what it's like now in the SHU. So we hear their demands, but what are the conditions like now for them?
Well, the conditions are being locked in your cell, the size of your bathroom, for mostly 24 hours a day. They get out twice a week for a brief shower. And there is also recreation that consists of, it's like a dog kennel for each individual prisoner can go into this dog kennel-like thing with wire mesh on all four sides and on the, you know, what would be the roof. The problem is that, and there's no recreational equipment or anything else in these kennels.
Do they get to look outside at all? Are there any windows in the cells and also the kennel that you're talking about?
The windows in the cell are, there's no window in the cell. There's a window in the front, a slit, and that's tinted so that they can't look out, but that the guards in the control booth can look in and watch them.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, on these on the recreation, there are 13 cages for 800 men. So not only are there not enough kennels for these guys to get out and get regular exercise, but also, you know, there's the guards are just lazy, and I don't want to get out. So they'll come up with any pretext, any excuse not to let these guys out for any kind of exercise outside their cells. So living conditions are stark.
The kennels are I'm sorry, those 13 cages, are they placed outside or are they inside of the building?
They're outside.
Oh, okay. So they actually do at least for at least
housed,
one.
Housed in walls. They can't see anything except up above them.
Oh, okay. So up above they could see the sky, but they can't see around them other than that.
Exactly.
Okay. So I was asking you, you told me about the conditions. Now I wanted to know what they're asking for. And as you talk about the, you mentioned some of the conditions, but as you talk about their some more of their demands, if you can say what it's like now for them. So they want this, but right now, this is what they're dealing with.
Right. Okay, well, to continue on just a little bit. Okay, so they're kept in their cells. And here's the thought I had that I wanted to get across. In the state of California, the law mandates for a primate that there be 100 square feet of unobstructed floor space for every 100 pounds of animal weight. These guys have about 20 square feet of unobstructed floor space, and that's often shared between two men. We're treating human beings worse than we would treat a primate. That just isn't right. These people have lost their liberty, but they still have a right to happiness, they should still have certain rights that they don't have as a result of because they're prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't right. They're more than prisoners or slaves. But we'll get into that in a moment. Let me touch on their demands.
Let me just ask you. You said that it's often shared with another inmate. So sometimes those cells have two people in them, not just one.
The overwhelming majority of them have two people.
Okay.
In the cell.
Okay.
It's rare that one prisoner. California is experiencing a severe overcrowding situation, and so they're. I mean, they have people sleeping triple bunked in gymnasiums and corridors. I mean, they're just, you know, in fact, there's a recent Supreme Court decision on that. I'll touch on it later if you'd like. So, you know, it's California prisons are just terrible. Mm-hmm. And so they've built all these security housing units, and now they have to keep them full. And so almost any pretext will get somebody put inside of a security housing unit inside a shoe. Mm-hmm. If you build it, they will come, I guess is the way that is.
Mm-hmm.
The first demand is for individual accountability. And what this means is that the prison staff are kind of lazy, and they would prefer to have the prisoners police themselves rather than them having to police the prisoners. So if someone on the tier acts out, they punish the entire tier. They punish everybody as a means to, you know, get the prisoners themselves to police themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is, as a result of the mental institutions being shut down during the Reagan era and whatever other reasons, a lot of people with mental problems have found their way into the prison system. And so the prisoners, they can't police these people who are suffering from mental disorders. And, you know, I've done time with these guys, you know, listening to them, you know, slam their heads against the wall, you know, their cell door. And, you know, the thunk. It's just terrible. There's a lot of people with mental problems inside the prisons, mm-hmm. and they're not being treated. They're just, you know, being warehoused, mm-hmm. kept in chemical straitjackets sometimes. Mm-hmm. So they want an end to the group punishment as a means to address rule violations. Okay, hold on. Yeah.
So you were talking about the number of folks who have mental illnesses who are in SHUs.
Right, and so when these people with mental problems act out, they punish the entire tier, and that's not right. You know, individual accountability. If I mess up, punish me. Don't punish my neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the second
demand is abolish the debriefing policy, and modify inactive. Active gang status, and so the only way that these guys can get out of the shoe, and like I say, some of them have been there for over 20 years, a lot of them for 10 plus years. I talked to the wife of a shoe prisoner yesterday. Her husband has been in the shoe on the status for 16 years. And the only reason he's on this status is because he refuses to debrief. He refuses to become a snitch. He's got some principles. And, I mean, 16 years in you know, a cell the size of your bathroom, I mean, that's pretty bad.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is, out here in Pennsylvania, where On the Block Radio is based, I haven't heard of any kind of practices used to identify prison gang members in PA institutions, correctional institutions. And I'm wondering, I didn't hear anything about any kind of debriefing out here, so I'm not sure how big of a problem it is in Pennsylvania. I'm wondering, are prison gangs, do you think, as far as you know, a bigger issue in California prisons than they are in PA or other parts of the states?
Yeah, gangs have been a big problem within the state of California. There was a very strong and active prison movement back in the mid-70s and late-70s. And as that movement petered out, and it made a lot of progressive judicial decisions came down out of the courts as a result of the strength of the prisoners' movement and their supporters on the outside. When that movement died out, the vacuum was taken up by prison gangs, the Aryan Brotherhood, the Black Guerrilla Family, the Mexican Mafia types, and so that was and continues to be a problem inside California's prisons.
So those groups like those, their focus has been, or one of their one of their actions has been to push prison officials to correct abuses in institutions, or is it simply to I'm talking about legally, you know, pushing out grievances, letter writing campaigns, contacting folks on the outside to help them deal with issues of abuse in the prisons? Or is it using their strength in numbers in ways outside of the legal system, like, you know, the same kind of things you would see from gang members on the streets?
It's the latter. It's the gang members are extra legal. They're not engaged in they've engaged in some legal activities, I'm sure, but like dealing drugs in the prisons and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely extra legal. But the issue is like the wife I talked to. With a husband that's has done over 16 years, mm-hmm. And he was a former, he was a gang member, and he dropped out 6 years ago. He's no contact, no affiliation, no gang activity whatsoever. And so, even though he was a gang member in the past, there has to be a time at some point, you know, that you can say, okay, well, he's not been active, he's not been engaged in this, he's not, you know, and we can try and let him out into the general population and see how he does. But instead, they hold him in there, even after they've grown out of that whole gang thing, they're not able to get out until such time as they debrief. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. And there's no question but what gangs are a problem in California prisons, and that prison administrators have a duty to try and break them up. There's no question about that. It is that after they're validated, well, first of all, California Prison Focus goes into the shoes and interviews prisoners. And on a recent interview earlier this month, we went in, and one of the questions that we asked was what is the percentage people who are validated incorrectly, wrongly validated as gang members. The lowest number we got was 50%. Mm. So there's the issue of people who are valid. If prisoners have been validated on the basis of receiving my newspaper, Prison Focus, because it mentioned the name George Jackson. I mean, on the flimsiest of pretexts, they will validate people. And so the issue is the threshold of evidence of gang activity needs to be higher. And then once, you know, it is found that a person's a gang member, then give that person an opportunity to demonstrate that he's no longer active, no longer a member of the gang. And that can be how many every years you want, but not 20 years, and not say you have to become a rat, you have to become a snitch, and let us own you for the rest of your life in order to get out. Mm-hmm. So that's the issue. It's not whether these guys have done bad things. It's the quality of evidence, that determines whether or not they're a gang member, and once they are validated as a gang member, what do they have to do to lose that moniker, that tag, short of snitching. Mm-hmm.
And what is the third demand?
The third demand is complying with the U.S. Commission 2006 recommendation regarding an end to long-term solitary confinement. There have been all kinds of studies. If your listeners are interested, they can go to www.prisons.org, click on the publications link, and look at issue number 36. It has another psychological study by a different group. There's just been all kinds of studies of the negative effects of keeping people isolated in solitary confinement for long terms. It's just, in fact, some studies have held that the sensory deprivation and long-term isolation is a form of torture. And somebody might not think it's torture, But like waterboarding, there was a Japanese means of torture used during World War II where they would tie a person down and just have water, a drop of water dropping on her forehead. And then that doesn't sound bad. But after drop, it becomes torture. It becomes, and that's what this is. I mean, in essence, the conditions that they keep these people under and the amount of time, it is, in fact, a form of torture.
Just a little background, the recommendation that you're talking about that came from the U.S. Commission on Safety and Abuse in Prisons, made in 2006, specifically recommended that officials make segregation a last resort, prison officials make it a last resort, and in conditions of isolation. I'm just wondering, what did that recommendation mean? How much teeth does the commission have, that commission have?
None. It's a recommendation. And you know, here's the thing. Prisoners are held in conditions of slavery. They're held in a condition of dependency, irresponsibility. They're disenfranchised from the political process under torturous conditions with massive overcrowding, medical neglect, and an environment that's dehumanizing and alienating to anybody. And so these people have been acted upon. They're like pawns that external forces act on. And the prisoners in themselves need to become actors on the stage of their own history. They need to become a part of the process. The state, all states, and the federal government, and probably all around the world, have treated prisoners as slaves. And the thing of it is, if you put an animal in a cage and you poke a stick in it at the animal day in and day out, week in and week out, year in and year out, not surprisingly, you're going to get an angry animal on your hands. And that's the same thing with these guys. And 98% of the prisoners are released, ultimately. And when they get out, they take that rage out on their wives, their children, the neighbors, the community. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't. The recidivism rate in the state of California, according to the former governor's website, is 70%. And not coincidentally, the unemployment rate for ex-offenders in the state of California is 70%. They spend a lot of money keeping these guys in the SHU, keeping a prisoner confined for a year. And it would actually be cheaper to send that prisoner to Harvard for a year to work to try and make a nuclear physicist of her or him as it would be to keep that person in prison. Now, if you have a suit of clothing that's got a rip in it, what you're going to do is you're going to apply a patch in order to make that fabric in that spot stronger. Well, we do exactly the opposite. Crime is a reflection of a weakness in the social fabric. But rather than strengthen that weak spot, we rip it open further by sending the guy to prison. That's expensive, and with the 70% recidivism rate, it obviously doesn't work. You don't get good things from doing bad things to people, and that's exactly what they're doing in there is they're doing bad things to people, and it doesn't work, and it's expensive. If you had a factory that produced a product with a 70% failure rate, the public would not buy your product, and your stockholders would be outraged. Mm-hmm. But yet, the prison officials who run these things are not held responsible at all. The California Department of Corrections renamed itself here about 3-4 years ago. They called themselves the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. All they've done is change the name. Now, there was a wave of riots throughout the United States back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And in response, they ushered in the era of rehabilitation. So what happened? Guards became correctional officers. Prisons became correctional institutions. Wardens became superintendents. Nothing changed except the name. And this is the same thing in California. Nothing has changed except the name. But getting back to the issue of responsibility, psychologists conducted an experiment by overcrowding mice and to see what the response is. And these mice engaged in all sorts of aberrant behavior, including cannibalism. Now, they have prisoners crowded into California prisons, into prisons across the United States. And there's aberrant behavior that takes place on the inside as a result of this. I've experienced it. But they shouldn't blame the mice. They should blame the psychologists who put them in that position. And the same is true with prisoners. The prison officials and the state need to be held responsible for these failures. But yet politicians and correctional officials, all they ask for is more of what doesn't work, more of what doesn't work. I'm getting off the track here. But
no, actually, that all to me relates to one of the other demands that the prisoners have, and that is for constructive programs for them in prison. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, okay. So we went into, on another one of our trips, actually the same trip, when we knew this strike was happening, we asked the prisoners, what is the one thing that you want most? And, a lot of things, frivolous things came to mind that they might want, but what was surprising is that the one thing that they wanted across the board was access to educational resources. They wanted to improve themselves. And so that is the fifth demand, to provide constructive programming and privileges for indefinite SHU status inmates. And that pretty much, access to the means to improve yourself, that pretty much is self-explanatory.
So most of the, in terms of the conditions that they're dealing with now, most of the prisoners in SHU, they're in their cells 23 hours a day. And are they given what
on
kind
a good
of...
day, yeah.
What'd you say?
On a good day, 23 hours.
On a good day. And they... Are any of them able to access any kind of educational materials, any kind of educational programs, or are they all prevented from that?
As far as I know, they are not allowed to have any kind of educational access, but I can't say that for sure.
And we're talking about books as well?
Oh, they have books.
Okay.
They have, but their books are limited to stuff that they get from the library, which is mostly, science fiction, Western, nothing new, nothing, I mean, it's mostly, prison libraries contain mostly just junk because, the librarians don't have any money to buy better stuff.
Can folks send books to prisoners in SHUs?
I don't know if they can or not. I just don't know. I just don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who have tried to send some. I know two people who have recently tried to send books in and had those books rejected.
Mm-hmm.
But those books were, one was written by a former prisoner, and I don't remember what the other one was, and they were both rejected as containing gang activity, and they weren't. I mean, the one book was Kevin Rashid Johnson's "Defying the Tomb,"
mm-hmm.
and there's no gang. There's no, I've read the book. I wrote a review of the book, and there's nothing about gang activity, but they reject, my newspaper for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I editorialize against gangs all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say these gangs serve the interests of the prison administrators, don't listen to them.
Right. Now, my understanding of what goes on in Pennsylvania prisons is that they can reject a book for any reason. If they feel that it would be a threat to security of the prison, then they will reject the book. And they just look at the titles for the main part. They look at the titles of the book. And if something seems as if it could contain information that could be incendiary, that could incite people to riot or to protest against conditions in the prisons, then they use that as a reason to deny the book.
Well, there's kind of an unofficial policy at Pelican Bay, and they define any in-prison political activism as gang activity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, political activism is prisoners' rights. And they try to criminalize and dehumanize politically conscious prisoners, labeling them as gang members. Mm-hmm. And also, when people try to send in revolutionary or leftist writings, they reject that on the basis of being gang activity.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to read a quote from Laura Magnani. Have you heard of her?
No, I haven't.
There was an excellent article that has been doing its circulation over the internet by Lee Ernesto of Global Research. It was on the conditions for SHU prisoners at Pelican Bay. And he, at the end of the article, he quotes Laura McNanny, who is the author of an American Friends Service Committee 2008 report called Buried Alive, Long-Term Isolation in California's Youth and Adult Prisons. And she was, earlier this year, she was on KPFK radio out there in Berkeley talking with Michael Slate, The Michael Slate Show. And this is what she said in regards to the rehabilitation efforts at Pelican Bay and the needs of SHU prisoners. It's not even just dreams. It's actually punishing you for having an intellectual life, for actually thinking outside the box, or for thinking at all. So the idea of barring people's access to certain kinds of thought, which is what censorship is extremely frightening. And we know from research that one of the best things that can happen to somebody doing a long prison sentence is for them to develop an intellectual life and start reading and start studying and start thinking for themselves. That's a way where you can really create a new life for yourself, or you can make your life meaningful, even if you never get out. But if you do get out, you make yourself a more productive member of society because you have a life. You're a thoughtful, educated person. What could be better? And instead, they're trying to really prevent that from happening. What are your thoughts on that?
That's true. And not only in terms of their educational life or learning life, but also Pelican Bay is located in a remote area of Northern California. And most of the prisoners who are housed there come from the major urban centers, Los Angeles area or the Bay Area, something like that. Family members and friends have to travel a long ways to get there. And visits are all through glass. There's no physical contact. And there's a camera on you while you're visiting, and your visit is recorded. What they do is they frighten visitors and even people who correspond with prisoners of Pelican Bay by claiming that they're being investigated for gang-related activity. And so these people are frightened away. All of this, like I said, everything works to isolate these guys and to push them down the path of becoming snitches. Anyway, it's good. I'll tell you what. I am a state-raised prisoner, a former prisoner, and I became politicized during the late 1960s.
And how long were you in prison?
Well, on my last stretch, I was in for 18 years. Mm-hmm. And while on the inside, I became politicized, and for the first time, I started reading and studying and you know, opening my mind, becoming more conscious. And while inside, I learned about computers. When I got out, I got a job as a network administrator and I did a very fine job. I was offered a job later in San Francisco, which I took as a computer systems manager for a company there. And when I left 10 years later to come back to Seattle, I was making $75,000 a year. I was paying taxes. I was, it's been 18 years since my release, and I have not been so much as questioned by the police. I'm a normal law-abiding. I own my own home. I'm, you know, married. I have, you know, life is good for me, and that could be the same with these guys. But they need to be allowed to become conscious. They need to be allowed to become educated. But the prison, the attitude of the prison administration is, the last thing we want on our hands is smart prisoners.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about there's another demand. We got four of them so far: individual accountability, a demand regarding debriefing, abolishing that whole practice. Another one regarding following through on the recommendation of that U.S. commission to end cruel and unusual punishment, or to use SHUs a lot less than they have been used, and also more constructive programs. There's another one, isn't there?
Yes. You didn't mention individual accountability. Yes, and there's one more. And that is to provide adequate food. Mm-hmm. These guys don't know what the administration does to their food. When I was in a SHU in Washington State, we would engage in struggle to try and improve conditions. And the guards would put soap chips in our mashed potatoes and bleach in our coffee. You're just really vulnerable. And so the demand is to provide adequate food. And as I said repeatedly, everything in the SHU is designed, even medical care. The doctor has been quoted as saying by repeated prisoners, in fact, they call him Dr. Death at the Pelican Bay SHU, if you want better medical treatment, debrief and go to another facility. You know, everything is aimed at getting you to debrief, including the food. The portions are smaller, the quality is less, one of the demands behind the food is that the staff must cease their use of food as a tool to punish prisoners. And they want someone, a sergeant or a lieutenant, to oversee the food, the preparation, the serving of the food. Mm-hmm. And they want adequate and healthy food. So that's that demand.
Again, quoting that or referencing the article by Lee Ernesto in Global Research. About Pelican Bay State Prison, he actually describes the prison as being infamous. These are his words: infamous for its inhumane conditions and extreme abuse. And I'm wondering if, as far as you know, is Pelican Bay State Prison distinctly different, a lot worse than other prisons in the U.S.?
Yeah, Pelican Bay SHU is worse than other SHUs.
In the United States,
the, quote, worst of the worst, mm-hmm. They say, and like I say, everything is aimed at debriefing. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Do you think that it is the worst of the worst because of the fact that they have such a they have a bigger problem with prison gangs than other prisons?
It's the worst of the worst. It's the worst SHU for a lot of reasons. Listeners can go on to the CBS website under 60 Minutes and look at their past programs. Some years ago, there was a segment on 60 Minutes about this prisoner who didn't keep himself clean enough to suit the standards of the guards, was pulled out of his cell and put in a tub of scalding water and cleaned with wire brushes. This is a 60 minutes investigation on somebody held in the Pelican Bay Shoe. It's not, I mean, you'd think something like that would be, you know, would be, well, it's beyond words. I don't know what to say about that kind of treatment. But yeah, this is Pelican Bay. It's a terrible place to, it's a terrible place to be. It's a terrible place to hold human beings in those kind of conditions. And I'm glad to see that the prisoners themselves are taking steps, even at the expense of their own health, to bring this to the situation to public attention and to try and bring about change.
Can you tell the listeners more about who these prisoners are who are striking? We already know that they have been victims, or they have been asked not to they're refusing to snitch through the debriefing process. But what about things like their racial makeup and reasons why they were imprisoned in the first place, and parts of the state that they're from?
The guy I was talking about earlier, who is a gang member, is from the state of Texas. I don't know what kind of crimes these guys committed. I assume that they're not in there for shoplifting. I assume that there's some pretty bad actors. But, you know, vindictiveness is not a quality that we try and teach our children. It's not a quality that we preach from the pulpit. And yet that's the way society is toward these people. And all I can say is that the strike is made up of Southern Hispanics, Northern Hispanics, who have traditionally been at war with each other.
You mean Southern in terms of Southern California and Northern California?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah. And black prisoners validated as black guerrilla family members, and white prisoners validated as members of Aryan Brotherhood or the Nazi lowriders. So these prisoners have set aside their philosophical racial differences and have come together to participate in this strike, in this hunger strike, which is quite an amazing accomplishment for the state of California.
Now, I'm wondering, the ethnic groups, African-Americans, Latinos, they represent a good deal more of the population, percentage of the population in SHUs than do whites. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. People of color make up a much larger percentage. For example, across the United States, there's a 13% of the population is black, but 35% of the prison population is black.
Mm-hmm.
And that holds the same for other people of color, with the exception of Asians as well.
Mm-hmm. And is that those numbers, those percentages, is that represented in the makeup of the prison hunger strikers?
I think so. The guy whose wife I talked to yesterday said he's the only white on his tier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm wondering, I know that the organization that you work with, California Prison in Focus. California Prison Focus. They're calling for political entities like Governor Jerry Brown and folks at the CDCR, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation officials there, Secretary Matthew Cate, Secretary Matthew Cate, and also Warden Gray Lewis, to act on these demands. Have you gotten any response from them?
I read a letter from the wife of one of the Shoe prisoners. She had just come back from a visit. And she said, the prison administration has just put out the menu for the July 4th meal that they're going to be serving in the Shoe. Mm-hmm. Hot links, strawberry shortcake, and ice cream. This guy, her husband said, I've been down for over 20 years. I've never seen a single strawberry in all that time. So one of the things that they're doing is to try and entice prisoners to come off hunger strike in order. I mean, it's a cheap shot. These guys are getting ready to indefinite hunger strike for as long as it takes, and they're going to try and bribe them with some strawberry shortcake and ice cream. So that's one thing that they're doing. On the other hand, when we communicate with those people, they say, oh, we're aware of the demands and we're working on them. But there was a hunger strike also in 2002. It was not as together as this. There was not as much public support. There was not as, you know, and the prison administration says, oh, yes, well, we're going to meet your demands. And the guys came off their hunger strike, and then nothing happened. Mm-hmm. So now, almost 10 years later, we're going into this again. Now, there's a coalition of people in the Bay Area. All of Us or None, which is an organization of ex-convicts, primarily black. The California Coalition for Women Prisoners. Prison Activist Resource Center. California Prison Focus. National Lawyers Guild. Prison Law Office. The ACLU, and a number of other organizations have come together to support this hunger strike. There's also demonstrations taking place in Montreal, in Quebec, and in Toronto behind this. We're planning demonstrations in Seattle, in the Bay Area. I'm leaving on Monday for the Bay Area to participate in them. And so there's a lot of organizing going on around this. But ultimately, applying pressure to the prisoncrats is to get them to do the right thing is not going to win, probably. What has to happen is that the prisoners themselves, the change has to come from the bottom up. Now, these guys, alleged gang leaders are the shot callers. If this takes place, there's some likelihood that other prisons, in fact, the Corcoran Shoe has already signed on to the hunger strike. Mm-hmm. There's a possibility that other prisons and prisoners will go on work strikes. Maybe that'll happen in more states than just California. But if there is ever a time to draw a line in the sand, that time is now. The correlation of forces is just right. The outside support is there. This is the time to stop the ongoing and continuous attack against prisoners that has taken place for the last 20 years. It's got to stop, and the time to stop it is now. And it's got to be prisoners themselves that engage in the process of change and not be, like I said, just pawns that are acted upon external forces.
What has been the media's response to the announcement of this hunger strike?
Total silence. And when they do respond, they're going to interview wardens, superintendents, guards. They're never going to hint that the prisoners have an issue. Mm-hmm. They're going to pick out one demand. We want adequate food. Oh, they're just striking because they want more peanut butter on the main line or something. You know, that's how they're going to respond to it. The media is.
I want to go back to discussing the fight in the legal arena, the fight by prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison. I know that there was a formal complaint that was. That was filed by some prisoners and who are in the SHU at Pelican Bay.
Yeah, that's the front page of my newspaper for this issue that just came out.
The front page of Prison Focus, right? I saw that.
Yes.
Yes. When was that filed?
Well.
And who was it filed with?
It's it's a lengthy document. But what it does is it goes into great detail about the law and the studies and how it's wrong and why it's wrong as a matter of law to treat people the way that they're being treated, the absence of due process and other constitutional protections. But the thing of it is that they can't rely on the courts. They have to rely on their own strength. You probably heard about the Supreme Court decision here about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, on overcrowding in the state of California.
No, I heard about the one on May 23rd. Can you talk about both of them, actually?
That's probably the one I'm talking about. Because there's only been one Supreme Court decision. Yeah, having to do with overcrowding in the state of California.
Can you talk more about that
Platter
particular
versus
one?
Brown.
I'm sorry, go ahead. What was it again?
That was Platter versus Brown. Mm-hmm. That case, there were two cases filed, Coleman versus Brown and then Platter versus Brown. Coleman versus Brown was filed in 1990, 21 years ago. The second case, Platter versus Brown, was filed in 2001, 10 years ago. Now, that was the majority court. Justice Kennedy, speaking for the majority, cited the lower court's finding that one prisoner a week in the state of California was dying as a result of medical neglect and medical malpractice, largely due to overcrowding. Now, 21 years, the state, people are dying, and the state fought this all the way. And then the court itself, in deciding whether or not this was cruel and unusual punishment, was sharply divided, 5-4. And then they only told the California you have to release 30,000 prisoners, only 30,000, and gave them 2 years within which to comply, and offered them an extension if they find that burdensome. Hmm. Well, nobody's going to get out. California's going to be shipping these, according to the governor, Brown, they're going to be shipping these people to other states, and they're going to be shipping them out to counties around the state of California and let the counties deal with these people. And so, you know, but the point is that it took this long, and people are dying, according to the court, one a week as a result of these conditions, and yet the court was divided and gave them all this time. So these guys are not going to rely on the courts to resolve their problem. The courts are a part of the problem. They're not a part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. Now that was the May 23rd ruling, or is that something different?
It was May 23rd.
Okay.
Well, I don't know the exact date. I know it was just recently.
Okay.
May 23rd sounds about right.
Now, that formal complaint that was filed, who did they file that with?
That was not filed with a court. That was public education. That was to educate people about just what it is and what the status of the law is on these issues and what's happening and what studies have been issued backing up what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. It was actually... Uh-huh.
It was informational. It's a long document, but it was informational. And then coupled with that was the five core demands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very well. Lots of good information in there. And I wanted to give the title of that write up to listeners because it's a very powerful title. The title is Formal Complaint on Human Rights Violations and Request for Action to End Over 20 Years of State-Sanctioned Torture to Extract Information from or Cause Mental Illness to California's Pelican Bay State Prison Security Housing Unit Prisoners. And that is on the front page of the summer 2011 edition of Prison Focus, which you can find on the California Prison Focus website, which is at www.prisons.org.
Under publications.
One of the other things that appears in that newspaper that edition of your newspaper is an article that you wrote about, I forget the title of it, but something about our strength.
Yes. There are 2.3 million prisoners in the United States today, in federal, state, and local facilities. And there's 7.3 million people in the U.S. who are under some form of judicial supervision, parole, probation, what have you. And there are 14 million people like me, ex-convicts. And that's almost 25 million people. And when we count the families and the friends and the supporters of these people, that's a huge number of people. But what this requires, so there's the potential for a strong movement exists. It's just a matter of building it. And these things have to be built through struggle. And struggle is what these guys in Pelican Bay are doing.
And one of the obstacles to building that movement, you state, is, quote, artificial divisions. Can you talk about that? What do you mean by that?
On the basis of race, the artificial divisions on the inside. Mm-hmm. If those guys can come together, then, now I wrote that before news of the hunger strike came out. And so, it's, you know, that is kind of a moot question. But let's get to the root cause of all this, if you have just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And that is the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution abolished slavery for everyone except those convicted of a crime. As a result of this, we have 2.3 million slaves in the United States. They're disenfranchised from the political process, and they're treated as slaves. Now, if these people were permitted to vote, politicians, they would have the ear of politicians because we're all grouped right together. There's 5,000 people in this prison. I want those 5,000 votes. So that's a part of it. So what has to happen is a movement developed to amend the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery for everyone in the United States. The United Nations Charter on Human Rights, which bars all forms of slavery, is a treaty that the United States has signed. And under the Constitution, the treaties are the supreme law of the land. So the 13th Amendment is currently in violation of those treaties. And so if you ask people, I mean, if the issue is framed correctly, you know, who in society openly supports slavery of millions of citizens? Who is pro-slavery? You know, not a lot of people are going to say yeah. And when put, you know, the number would be relatively small. When asking people who is in favor of disenfranchising millions of Americans from voting, from the electoral process, you know, the number would again be relatively small. And so it's this kind of a change in consciousness that has to happen inside the minds of the American people. And, it would be one thing if what they're doing now worked, but it only makes the problem worse. Mm-hmm. This whole deterrence thing, I remember reading a long time ago when I was younger about when I started reading and trying to get interested in what was going on in the world and that sort of thing, about 17th century England and how they used, how capital punishment came to be. They kept harsher and harsher and harsher punishments on top of, they kept doing the same thing over and over again until it was a capital offense to pick a pocket, to cut down a tree on a public lane, to shoot a rabbit on the king's land. And so they would be, the crowd would be gathered to watch the hanging of a pickpocket, and other pickpockets would be out practicing their trade on the people present to watch the hanging. I mean, it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so it's time to try something new, and that something new might be, heaven forbid, treat people as human beings. Treat them as you would like to be treated. Just you know, as you do unto the least of these, blah, blah, blah.
As in terms of a strategy, a practical outline for a strategy to address those issues, especially the fact that, as you state, the United States, because of its treatment of prisoners, in particular SHU prisoners, is in violation of treaties, which you're saying are considered supreme law of the land in the United States.
That's written right into the Constitution, that the treaties are the law, the supreme law of the land.
And also in violation of international law. So
yes.
What strategies are being proposed to address that? Is that to, for instance, approach the United Nations about these violations?
I was part of a struggle back in 1978 to abolish slavery in the United States, in the United Nations. And that didn't get anywhere. Petitioning, whether it's the state governor or the Department of Corrections or the United Nations, petitioning these people is, excuse the term, just wasting your time. I mean, you know, some people are going to do that, and it's a good thing that they do that, and, you know, it's nice. I mean, you know, liberals are good for that. You know, they're going to make the situation just, but ultimately, it's going to be the prisoners themselves, their family members, their friends, activists such as you and I, who build a struggle. It's got to be, you know, without struggle, there's not going to be any progress. And so that's what it's going to take. It's going to take prisoners themselves prisoners help run the prison system through their labor. All prisoners have to do is withdraw their labor, and they will get what they want. If you have the time, I'll tell you a story about how we did that one time.
Please.
Okay. I was a prisoner in the SHU, the Intensive Management Unit, a prison within a prison in Washington State back in the mid-70s. And we had metal walls between the cells and a metal table attached to that wall that, you know, we'd sit meat on. Well, we found that if you pound your fist on this little table, it reverberated loud. Now, there's 24 cells on the tier, and there's four tiers. And we got everybody to pound on their tables at the same time. Someone once said they could hear that sound all the way down the wall. That's not true, but it was very loud. And we knew when the main population went to the chow hall. And so every time the main population was going to the chow hall, they'd have to kind of walk right by Big Red, where the intensive managed IMU, and we'd be pounding, you know, boom, 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 boom. After 3 days of that, the entire penitentiary went down on a work strike. Their number one demand was to rectify conditions in the segregation unit. That strike went on for 47 days, the longest strike in United States history, as far as I know. Certainly the longest strike in Washington State history, and it remains that today. As a result of that, now for the first 44 days, nobody was interviewed except prison officials, the press. This is a big story. It was on the newspapers, the radio, the television, but not once was it ever hinted that prisoners had a point of view or that they had an issue. Only guards, correctional officials, superintendents, that sort of thing were interviewed. Well, a group, something happened that caught the attention of the news media, that they were not being even-handed in their treatment of this story. And so what happens is they interviewed some prisoners. Our side of the story got out. There was a change of consciousness in the state. I'd never seen anything like it before. Mm-hmm. A 180-degree flip. The Harold Bradley, the director of corrections, was fired. The warden was removed. The associate warden of custody was sent to a juvenile joint to practice his trade. And we were released from the intensive management unit. And we went on to form a group called Men Against Sexism to stop prisoner and on prisoner rape. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's a whole other story. The point of it is that if prisoners withdraw their labor, they have power because the prisons can't run without their labor. And that's the start. That's the mechanism. That's the means by which change will come about. That's the means by which the public will be educated about these things. They're not going to be educated by rewriting letters to the editor or petitioning some asshole in the government to, you know, please make things better, to go out there with hat in hand on our hands and knees and ask them to do the right thing. To hell with that.
What are some of the jobs that prisoners do to help prisons run?
They do everything. They cook the food. They clean the floors. They everything you can imagine, they do. Mm-hmm. Except you know, they don't man the guard towers. Mm-hmm. They don't carry the keys around. But everything else, everything that the guards don't do, they do. The prison cannot run without their labor. And it doesn't take long for them to discover how important to the functioning of the prison prison labor is. And it's also very expensive for them if they have to bring in a whole lot of other people to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. So they want to end these strikes soon. And the experience of the Georgia recently had a statewide prison strike. Mm-hmm. Of all the prisons in the state, it was just amazing. It was a first. It's never happened before. And that's the and they use family members to communicate between prisons. You know, this is what was happening on this date certain, and it happened. Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't have sustainability. It didn't last as long as it should have, but it was the roadmap. It was the direction in which things need to go in order to bring about constructive change.
Did they actually win any of their demands?
I don't know if they won. I know there was a lot of repression. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just didn't last long enough, and I don't know if they won or not. There's an article in the latest issue of Prison Focus on written by Mark Cook on page 4, and I'm not sure. Which he lists what their demands were, but I'm not sure if these demands were met or not. Mm-hmm. But the point is not whether they won. I mean, they could have won if they stayed with it longer. Mm-hmm. These things have to be sustained. It takes time for outside support, for example, to develop. We can't just mobilize on really quick. Now, in this case, the formal complaint and the 5 core demands were delivered to the governor and to the Secretary Kate back in February of this year. I mean, they've been planning for this for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, in that example you mentioned about Washington State, the protests at Washington State, were they banging on the metal tables in order to attract the attention of the general population, and then it was folks in the general population who wound up bringing about or calling for a hunger strike and getting involved in a hunger strike there?
Not a hunger strike. It was not a hunger strike. It was a work strike.
Oh, I'm sorry, a work strike. Yes. Is that what happened?
That's what happened. But it didn't just happen out of the blue. We had been engaged in struggle inside the IMU for a long time. In fact, if any of your listeners ever have access to a book called Concrete Mama that was written during that period, they can see on the end of our chair, written in ketchup in letters 3 feet high, were the words, "We will win." We would throw everything that would burn in ourselves out on the chair and light it on fire. We'd other times, we'd put sheets in the toilets so the water wouldn't drain, and then we'd hold the flush buttons down, and we'd all be doing this at the same time and flood the place. I mean, we'd write articles for progressive publications. We had a little newsletter that we typed up and sent out with carbon copies. Mm-hmm. So I was publishing a newspaper called it was a little magazine called The Red Dragon. Oh, a lot of stuff led up to this. The prisoners knew what our conditions were. We led, you know, they knew what was going on. It just took the pounding to put them over the edge.
Mm-hmm. Now, California Prison Focus is involved with a number of other organizations in the Bay Area in organizing the outside forces to support the hunger strike at Pelican Bay. How does I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are curious. In light of what happened at prisons in the state of Georgia, in terms of family members communicating with their loved ones in prisons and sending information to other prisons in the state, and that helping to build that movement there, how has the movement been built for this hunger strike in California? What kind of techniques have you used?
Well, there's, like I pointed out earlier, there's a number of organizations, from Critical Resistance to All of Us or None. And there's a legal committee that consists of the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Prison Law Project, and also independent attorneys. That's one aspect of it, getting access to the prisoners, monitoring the administration's treatment of them. We want to be able to weigh these prisoners. We want to be able to monitor what's going on. Now, there's a policy in the state of California in terms of hunger strikes. You announce that you're going on a hunger strike. They come in and take everything that might be food out of your house. And they're supposed to weigh you every day. There's a whole policy on that. But we don't trust the prison administrators to be. Now, even though all food has been taken from their cell, we don't trust prison administrators not to say, oh, they're eating, they're gaining weight, they're not losing weight, or stuff like that. So there's that level of it. And there's people organizing demonstrations. There's people putting together poster stickers, postcards. There's a media committee that will be working with the media, and there are probably other things going on that I don't know about.
How are folks
in Seattle?
Right. And how are folks in those organizations able to access prisoners?
When California Prison Focus goes in, we go in with a lawyer and investigators, mm-hmm. and the investigators interview prisoners and talk to them about conditions and what's going on. All of Us or None and some attorneys will be going in on the 28th and talking to prisoners. And on the 29th, California Prison Focus will be going into Pelican Bay. I mentioned talking to the partner of a prisoner that's done 16 years. She is leaving today for Crescent City, where Pelican Bay is located. She's taking a tent, and she's going to camp out there and be on site for the duration of the struggle. Mm. And others will be joining her. Ex-cons will be engaging in a hunger. Will be fasting, not eating, at the UN Plaza on July 1st, and just a whole bunch of other stuff is happening. A lot of, things like this. So
the UN Plaza in New York?
Beg your pardon?
The UN Plaza in New York?
I still didn't hear you.
The United Nations Plaza in New York City?
No. There's a United Nations Plaza in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Downtown San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is... I'm actually wondering, is there an organization like the Pennsylvania Prison Society out there in California that allows you to apply to be an official visitor and able to get access to any prison you want in that state?
Not that I know of. You can become a visitor of some prison, mm-hmm. prisoner, but you can just visit that one prisoner. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to be on the visiting list of multiple prisoners.
Okay. I wanted to, in light of the fact that there is going to be a conference, actually it started today, the Allied Media Conference. You know about that conference in Detroit?
No, I don't.
It's a group of media organizations that come together, representatives, different folks working in different aspects of media, alternative media in the world, actually come to Detroit. Usually is held in Detroit every summer. And it's a conference. There's lots of skill building workshops and informational sessions. There's actually a track. I noticed this last night looking at the schedule. There's a track specific to the use of media as a tool in prison justice movements. And I'm wondering, I know that you are a you work, you're connected to, or California Prison Focus has a radio show on KPOO.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could speak about how media effective radio has been in building this movement and how you would like to see it be used in the future.
Well, we're about to see how effective radio will be. As I said, there are some people who look to government officials as the agents of change, and there are some people who look to the impacted people, the oppressed, as the agent of change, and of course, I'm a member of the latter. One of the problems with radio is that it doesn't reach a lot of prisoners, and that's who we're trying to reach. I have once thought about getting a little van with a pirate radio set up and driving it from prison to prison and broadcasting into prisoners, but that has never come about. That's, you know, that would be a good job for somebody to do. It's, you know, certainly work that needs to be done.
Because prisoners,
answers your question or not.
Because prisoners do have access to radios?
Yeah, for the most part they do.
What about prisoners in
television?
And television. What about prisoners in SHUs?
I don't think they do, but here again, I'm not sure. I don't think they have access to television.
Okay.
And whether they have radio, well, they do have access to radio. I know that because one of the hunger strikers, a Hispanic, asked me to contact a bunch of Hispanic media outlets that they listen to with information about the upcoming strike.
Okay. I really appreciate it. It was so informative. I'm really excited about the strike. And if folks want to get involved out here in the eastern part of the states, what can they do? What are some contact information you can give them?
Well, they can go to the website of California Prison Focus and you can send an email to contact@prisons.org and say you want to be helpful, say you would like more information.
And any
prisoners listening to this, I think they got the message.
And the website for California Prison Focus is?
www.prisons.org.
Okay, and what time does your, is KPOO online?
It is. It's streamed online. I'll be doing a program on the 29th at 11:30 Pacific time on the hunger strike.
The website address?
The website is www.kpoo.org.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Mead.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, same here. Take care.